Hello there, and welcome to episode number 7 of the Dow of Tech podcast, an interview with HG World writer Jay Smith. The Dow of Tech is going to be your weekly dose in the way of technology. Episodes will be featuring the weekly geeky goings-on of me, your host, Mark Prestash. Shows will generally focus on a couple of tech topics a week, including software, hardware, and everything tech related from the coolest geek toys to the best in podcast novels. We're doing another interview show for you guys on the Dow of Tech. Today I'm talking with Jay Smith, the writer of the podcast audio drama HG World. Jay heard my interview with Dead Hunt author Ken Crawford, and we got to talking. After some back-and-forth direct messages on Twitter, Jay agreed to come on to the Dow of Tech to talk about HG World. I had a great time talking with Jay, so without further ado, here is my interview with Jay Smith.
We're proud to present our second interview on the Dow of Tech. We are talking with the writer of the fantastic audio novel podcast, HG World, Mr. Jay Smith. Jay, thank you and welcome for coming on and talking with me on the Dow of Tech today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
So you are Jay Smith. What exactly is your title as far as HG World goes?
Oh, I'm the writer and executive producer. I direct the shows, which is kind of a misnomer. I actually coordinate the show. I don't really direct actors. I just kind of direct their sound clips. But I'm a director, writer, and I oversee the entire production.
Interesting. Now, when did you actually start to write?
The show or in general?
Let's go with in general first.
As soon as somebody handed me a pen, I've been writing since I could form letters with my hands. And that seems to be the only thing that has been consistent throughout my life is that I love creating stories. I love creating characters. And, I did the whole thing. I went through school. I was on the school newspaper, in the school literary journal, college newspaper, theater, that sort of thing.
Oh, so that there still should be some work out there of yours floating around that we could dig up on the internet, maybe?
I'm sure that there's some really bad poetry out there somewhere with my name on it, and I'm sure if you go to Millersville or Penn State, there's an archive with a couple of articles of mine and commentary about God, love, and politics. But my only professional credits really are I wrote self-published a book a couple years ago called Rise of the Monkey Lord, which is a role-playing and tech-based cyber fantasy, which is actually a sequel to a film that I made in 1999, a really bad horror movie that friends and I made back in the day. And that, if you can find that on YouTube, that's worth a couple of snorts of vodka and about 2 hours of your time.
I actually was just reading about that a couple of days ago when I was doing research for the interview on the HG World Wiki. That's part of your bio, if I recall.
Yeah.
So let's get into HG World a little bit. Now, the show has been out for what, a little over a year now, right?
Just about a year. We started the Heroes of the Zombie War preface or prologue to the series back in May or June of last year. And we started season zero, I believe, June 25th last year.
Yeah, actually, I actually wrote an interesting post on your website regarding how I started listening to HG World. And
yes, you did.
And yes, I made your blood on your website there. When I look back on Heroes of the Zombie War, I get what you were doing. It's just at the time, I didn't quite know what was going on. But I think it's a really interesting way to introduce the people to the characters, especially Todd Rage, because he really is the glue, I think, of the show. He really, he'll come in and you'll intro the show with something that Todd says, then it sort of rolls out into the story. And usually, he's sort of like your springboard for the show, right?
Yeah, I pitched the idea to Keith DeCandido, who's the voice of Todd Rage, as you're the Rod Serling for the show, or you're kind of the Greek chorus. You're the conscience of this location. So you can't, in a radio show, you can't have this big, great establishing shot of the valley, which I would love to have. But I wanted to embody that small town feel in some way. Mm-hmm. And that was the best way I could think about was, if this valley had a face and a voice, what would it be? And I thought that's Todd Rage.
I grew up in a very small town and they had a local radio station. Mm-hmm. And they had a DJ that was there for God. I think he's still there. I mean, I'm 35 years old and I remember growing up with this guy. I always think of 1420 WLIS whenever I hear Todd Rage. It just reminds me of that, that really small town, hometown radio station.
Yeah, well, he's based on. I grew up in the 70s listening to AM radio, and yeah, like you, we had back then. You had mom and pop run stations with a low wattage transmitter, mm-hmm. and they would just say whatever they want, play whatever they want, and they buttered their bread on local businesses. And so if you know the disc jockey got back from the store and he had a bone to pick with somebody, he would spend an hour talking about that, and then he would play six Buddy Holly records in a row, and he didn't care.
Yep.
So yeah, that's the cool thing about the Algonquin Valley. There are a lot of places like that in Pennsylvania, and I wanted to capture that small town feel with Heroes. Kind of getting back to the original point, but I wanted also to give the listeners an idea of where they were without having to slow the original story down.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got to season zero, I really wanted to hit the ground running and start, you know, terrifying people and bring the zombies in. But your point earlier was something that a lot of listeners commented about. You have a zombie story, but I have yet to hear or see a zombie. So we had to overcome that with season zero.
You definitely did. No doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so for people that don't know, H.G. World is the story of survivors in a zombie apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was your inspiration for actually writing H.G. World? Was it you just woke up and said, Eureka, one day, or was it a slower process?
It was a slow process. H.G. World was actually first written down probably in the early, probably early 2001, 2002. It was more of a response to everybody's paranoia and fear about the world coming to an end in a way that I hadn't heard since the 80s when, you know, everyone was terrified that a nuclear war could break out at any moment. And we started talking about how is the world going to end, not if. And I started to think, you know, I really don't want to do a story about terrorism. I didn't want to do a politically charged story that would polarize the audience. And I thought I really wanted to talk about how people would react in a situation like that. And kind of bring in the argument about self-sufficiency, self-reliance, are we too dependent on the government? Are we shutting ourselves off from our communities? And I wasn't sure how to present it. Originally, it was supposed to be a novel or short story, a series of short stories. I considered doing it as a comic book when I had a business relationship with a guy who did really, really cool zombie artwork.
Cool. That would actually be really cool, I think.
Yeah. And then, you know, the comic book The Walking Dead came out, and I thought, well, I don't need to do that now. He's telling that story. But it evolved over a period of years, and one day I was at the Home Depot with my son. He was looking around at Home Depot, and I didn't know what he was thinking, and I was, what are you looking for? And he said, you know, this would be a great place to hide out when the zombies come.
Nice.
I thought, that's an interesting – first of all, that's a freaky thought, but you are my son, so I guess I can't ding you for that. But as we walked around, I thought, the only thing this place is missing is really a food stocks. This would be a perfect place to hide out for a long term if you had supplies to keep fed and watered. And if it were on a well, and that last piece of the puzzle about how to keep all these people fed was, you know, that came later. But yeah, it was so defensible that I would rather be there than at a Costco where – you know, that's the first place people would go.
Well, that's really interesting. I had always thought that H.G. World was really sort of a play on Walmart more so than the Home Depot.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. I think maybe it was just my thought. But I guess now that you say it, I really see what you're saying there.
Oh, well, in Heroes of the Zombie War, we really played that up. So, yeah, if you're coming from it through Heroes of the Zombie War, where we did that whole opening extravaganza thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
I modeled Jenny Jo in that based on the big box retailers. I used to work for Target, and I'm in human resources, so a lot of that stuff is just aching to be parodied.
Right.
So yeah, that grand opening carnival atmosphere, absolutely.
Interesting. Well, okay. Well, then we're talking about zombies here, so we're talking about a story in the horror genre. Is horror a genre that you like to write about? Is it interest you, or is it more just a vehicle to get your thoughts and the story across?
It's more a vehicle. I mean, I grew up reading Lovecraft and Clark Ashton Smith and August Derleth and Robert E. Howard, and there's a lot of violence, a lot of darkness in it. I like that material to a point. I love the mythology. I love the artistry of how they weave their words, but the dread and the darkness and the horror doesn't really appeal to me. In fact, I kind of go the other way. I tend to introduce horror as the adversary, but it's never a foregone conclusion that you're going to die. You always have an option. You always have the ability to fight back and struggle against the darkness. So my stuff is more about the adventure mm-hmm. than confronting horrible things rather than, you know, what's going to eat you next.
Well, I've always said to people that I feel like a lot of what happens in HG World, the horror that you hear is less about the zombies themselves than what the people do to the other people.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought that you're, again, it's sort of your take on humanity and what people would or could do in that sort of situation.
Yeah. I was on a panel with Jonathan Mayberry, who's a wonder, like he is the zombie guy right now. He wrote Zombie CSU, and he is an encyclopedia of zombie knowledge. And he made the point that, like, vampire stories are about the vampires. Zombie stories are about the survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly in an audio drama where you cannot be fascinated by the grotesque makeup and the macabre imagery, you have to focus on how this impacts your characters. And it's far more horrifying to talk about what people will do when they're up against a wall and their lives have been destroyed. In many ways, you can take reference from the refugees in Hurricane Katrina at the Superdome
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and all the stories that came out of that. I have always found it, the atrocities that people will commit to protect themselves are as fascinating as the stories of heroism and sacrifice. So hopefully we're tempering those bad things with examples of how to live your life after the zombie apocalypse.
Are the characters, are they based on real people? Are they all just completely made up?
I think there are influences. Jenny Jo is the embodiment of human resource professionals that I know.
Right.
And she embodies the worst of those traits, I think.
With a smile.
Yeah, the five S's and all that yep, stuff, the yep. huddles. But I've known a Jack and a David, but really they're all fresh from the brain, I guess.
Okay, so they're really not based. I mean, you may be pulling from here for there, but they're really sort of standalone characters. You know, you don't know these people.
Well, the only exception I would say is that I wrote Hicks as a young Ash from Evil Dead.
Okay.
I envisioned him as, you know, he's going to grow up to be Ash one day because he's just going to be so messed up by the end of HG World that he's going to see dead
ideas.
Exactly. I think I actually let a couple of those lines slip in there. Give me some sugar and come get some.
Yeah. When he and Ronnie seem to have a little spark going on there. Yeah, exactly. So now, what's the process like for you to write an episode? I mean, does it usually take you a couple of days, a couple of weeks? I mean, what's your process to get an episode written?
Oh, man. Some of the episodes went very, very fast. The original episodes when I thought I didn't have a cast to assign roles, and it was just 15 minutes of airtime that went through very quickly. But as things go along, and as we've taken on more characters and we're bringing in more listeners, I think the pressure to raise the bar and deliver a good show slows the process down considerably. Right now, as I'm talking, we're writing episode 8 of season 1 out of 12, and it's the literary equivalent of constipation. It just will not come. Just because I'm second and third guessing myself, I have to start wrapping the show up. I can't continue to do what Lost does and just continue to add questions upon questions upon questions. I have to start resolving this stuff. And I'm thinking, is this the right way to go? Is this, are they going to buy this? Is it getting too weird? That sort of thing. So right now it's more a process of ensuring quality as the episodes are done. And that does take a lot more time than I would typically like to spend on a script of 60 minutes.
Now, do you springboard ideas off other people, like your wife or other people involved in the show, or do you prefer to write it out all by yourself and then get reaction from them or whatever after that?
At the moment, I actually like to talk to the actors because they have shown me a lot of opportunities for their characters that I wouldn't have thought, and that's simply based on the quality of their performance. I'll talk to, say, for example, Gwen, who plays Joe. Joe is a really complicated character, and it's not the easiest character for me to write. So I'll talk to Gwen, who plays Joe, and ask her, I want to do this with her. What do you think her reaction would be? What do you think? Would you play that? And she'd give me her feedback.
Yeah, it's always an interesting thing when, you know, you as a writer, you know, you think, okay, well, this is what I'm writing and this is the way it is. But then the, you know, the actors, they take on their personas of those characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, how many times have we all heard an actor talk about how they know the character because they play them, they voice them, they do the motions. They understand the character sometimes in a different way than the writer does.
Yeah, I have not been – there has never been a time that I was not amazed by the work that came back from the actors in season zero. I love working with these guys. And for example, M. Sierra Garcia, who by her own admission is late getting the material to me because she's in a bunch of different shows and her real life interferes. Whenever she gives me stuff, it just knocks me on the floor. I love how she portrays Sarge and Jenny Jo. Dan Kelly's Jebediah. I every time I hear his voice, I want to make him darker. I have phrases I know I would love to hear come out of Dan's mouth to create Jebediah's persona. But yeah, and I will also run things by Mike Stokes and Carol Stokes, who are other producers, and say, well, what do you think? Would you buy this if you were listening to the show? And they're usually very, very candid about the ideas that I bounce off of them.
One of the things I love about HG World is that it's not just a straight read. It's the characters, and then post, you know, Mike throws in the sound effects and the background music. And you know, do you write the scripts and sort of in your mind as you're writing them, thinking about the sound effects that will go into the show later on? Or do you really just concern yourself more with the writing and let Mike and them figure out all the effects that have to go into the show?
All of it. I try to include as much information from Mike as possible. And in a zombie show, there are unconventional sound effects. So yeah. I just try to describe exactly what the person should hear. It's not really consistent. We've tried things like introducing a scene in the script and then describing, summarizing the scene, the emotions of the characters in that scene, and the ambiance. You know, how should this scene feel to the listener? And then Mike interprets that, and he adds his own creative genius to it, and it comes out sounding great.
Yeah, I mean, I got to admit, I mean, it definitely, you know, sometimes in other audio dramas, the sound effects, they almost take over the story, mm-hmm. and it's a bit too much, a little over the top. I always think in something like this, it sort of adds nuance as opposed to being the central character, really being the central theme of, you know, what's going on.
Yeah. I try to make it character driven. I try to exposition is kind of tough balance in a radio show. You can't say, look, there's a glass on the table. I'm going to pick that glass up.
Yeah.
But there's the challenges, I guess, in the vocabulary of the characters. They will talk about everything, but not in such a direct way. So you don't necessarily need all those sound effects.
It's hand me that glass on the table versus look at that glass at the table over there. Will you please give it to me? Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
that is the ugliest glass I have ever seen in my life. Is that the only one you have? Fine.
Let me walk over to my kitchen cabinet. Yeah. Well, speaking about characters, who are your favorite characters to write? I know personally, I love Dogberry. Mm-hmm. I do have a hard time at times. I have to rewind and go back and see, okay, what did he say?
Yeah.
Sometimes, it's just that damn funny. But sometimes it's just I didn't quite catch it. But yeah, I love Dogberry. I love Major Grant and McGinnis. I love Hicks. Who were your favorite characters to write for?
Yeah, that's interesting because Dogberry was written as I really didn't think people would like him. I thought that would be the character that everyone would want to see killed off in as grotesque a manner as possible.
When you first introduced him, I was like, okay, this is going to get really Deliverance-y on here.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I'm in. I'm here. But like, okay, let's see what happens. And it didn't. I think he's become a really fun character because you introduce him in such a way that you don't really have a lot of expectations for the character, but there's a lot more underneath that has been coming up recent stories that really makes him a very fun character to listen to.
He's a delight to write. I don't use the word delight very often, but when I sit down, I can hear Lee Sand's voice in my head, just kind of like Dan Kelly, where I know what Lee's limitations are. And mm-hmm. I know I'm going to get back a kind of garbled take sometimes, but that's kind of Dogberry's character now.
Yeah.
And I will right now, I just finished writing a script where Dogberry comes back into the story after a long absence, and he has the camera equipment from the helicopter that he stole, and he's introducing his treehouse. like the intro to an episode of MTV's Cribs.
Nice.
And that was just that was a lot of fun to write. I have him singing a song later in season one too.
I see now that we're talking about Dog Bear, I can hear, this is my headed chapter.
Yes.
Some of the things he says just really just, I mean, they're funny, and he's like a, I'm going to say hero, but he is in a sense, you know, he seems to be pretty smart on his feet. Definitely a fun character.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's in the bio on the wiki, but he is a former .com executive who lost everything, and he went on Walkabout and ended up with no money near Wishwell and just wandered off into the woods one day and became part of it.
That's funny. So you have a rather lengthy, large body of work. Do you have a favorite scene that you've written? My favorite scene so far has got to be the introduction of McGinnis and Grant. Two soldiers shooting the breeze, filling up a building with gasoline or something, and zombies, and they're making a bet on how many shots it will take to destroy the building. Just, I mean, I love that scene, and that's actually a fairly old scene. It's just so much fun to I love McGinnis's voice. I love that Scottish just kind of, you know.
Oh, Ayub is great. That's another one I love.
Stokes is great as Major Grant. Just I love the interplay between those two characters, and like I said, the way they were introduced, it's very almost like Apocalypse Now, where they're coming in and they're dropping the napalm on the village there. Mm-hmm. Just they're coming in guns blazing, and it's a really fun introduction to the characters.
Yeah, I like writing those two. I try to reach back to Tom Stoppard's influence when I write those guys, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Just had the way they play off one another, and I do like that scene. I think the one that I look back on with most fondness is episode one, which was the test, where you have the four. It's basically a slasher film, the homage to the bad 80s Halloween, Friday the 13th type story. The innocent kids, some are up to no good, some are virtuous. And
Yeah.
And that was fun. But the most rewarding one was probably the scene with Doreen's scene in the barn, which was hellish to get through. Mike deserves a lot of credit for the way he edited that scene together, because it was a lot worse the first take. Well, the first time through, I shared it with the cast members, and you know, we all decided, you know, this might be a little bit too much. But in the end, I thought it was a very effective way of telling that part of the story.
Well, see, you know, it seems like that I think make me say that H.G. World, I think, is more about the horror of people, you know, the horror of man, what he does to his fellow man, versus the horror of what the zombies do. I mean, you know what you're getting with the zombies. I mean, they catch you, that's it. You know what you're getting. With a person, you don't know what you're going to get. You don't know what they're thinking. You don't know what they're thinking and plotting to do to you. You know, and what they're, and the depths that they're capable of going down to.
Yeah. Well, with I described this to Tracy Hall, who plays Doreen, as I really want to take a character and I want to show how far you can push somebody, how stressed you can make them, and still see them come out as a good person, and still show that those traits of charity and self-sacrifice. And she was very reluctant initially to do the scene and I assured her we would handle it well. I said, I really need to deconstruct Doreen. She lost her son. Her husband's missing. Her only anchor left in the world is her son, Aaron. And we're probably going to address that down the road, too. What more could we possibly do to this poor woman? And why is it that she's holding it together? What is her motivation? How can she possibly be sane and functional at this point? And I thought that was an interesting challenge to take on, just to say, why? I mean, what is her motivation? What drives her? I think it's her son, but also this community that she's helped build and support at the church. Now, that was a great scene because of Eric and Tracy and Mike doing an excellent job. Subject matter was horrifying to me, but in the end, it was very, very well produced.
I know. When I listened to it, I distinctly recall this. She walks into the barn, and I kind of had this idea. I'm like, uh-oh. like, they're not going to go there. Are they really? I was nervous or apprehensive about what was going to happen because I had a pretty good idea what was going to happen next. And I remember sitting there, and I usually listen in my car. And I remember I had pulled up to the house. I had gotten to my house, and I couldn't turn it off. And, you know, I was sitting there with my mouth open like, oh, my God. I was really blown away by it. I really was. And I think it really reaffirmed, I think, why I like the show. Again, you know, once I heard it, I got what you were doing. You know, it made sense to me, you know, what you were trying to get across, I thought, about this character. And it's sort of like, how much more can this girl take? You know, how much more does she have to endure? Is this the thing that's going to finally break her? Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to say it doesn't sound like it was.
Good. It's also, you tend to get desensitized by episode 6. You hear a lot of, oh my God, here the zombies chomp.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, it's just not, it's the actor takes a bite of an apple. We cut it together. And in some listeners will think it's, they'll put a check on their board and say, oh, that's another body for the count. And we really wanted to say, this is horror. This is a very bad situation for a lot of people. How do we illustrate that in a way that's fresh and visceral? And that was the only way I could think of to, you could kill somebody, you take their piece off the board and you forget about them. And in some cases, if the characters are good, you sort of go, oh, that sucks. I really like that character, but you move on. This, it lingers. You know, she's carrying that with her. Every time you hear Doreen's voice, the first thing you think of is tragedy. And that's what I want to convey.
Do you think that when you write that you're trying to weave in messages to your audience, whether they be political or religious, or I mean, is there an underlying theme, I guess, that you're trying to? I mean, I think we've touched on it, but is there a point, I guess, you're trying to get across?
Not consciously. Early on, there were some listeners who tagged it as a right-wing show. I wasn't quite sure what they meant by that, except maybe that the message was you can't trust your government. You have to rely on yourself, which, you know, that's true. But it's not a metaphor for the Tea Party or any political movement. It's just more about what are your true values. You know, integrity is what you demonstrate when no one else is looking. You know, if the law is not there, what do you do?
Mm.
That's more of an exploration of different characters doing different things. So I don't think I have one message, except possibly toward the end of season one, where you heard Pastor Dawkins give his speech and the mayor of H.G. World giving his speech at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back and forth. Yeah, that was pretty
cool.
And
having, you know, hearing the values of those two individuals to basically tell the listener, you know, you can choose a side. Which one do you think is good? Which one do you think is evil? Or is there a choice? And maybe that's in terms of setting up a gray area for good and evil, saying that no one is truly good, no one is truly evil. Everyone has the capacity for both, and it's this kind of circumstance that brings out the opportunity to favor one or the other. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I've always felt that way too. I've always felt like people are inherently good. Mm-hmm. I think circumstances force people to do things that they probably normally wouldn't do any other time ever, except in that one circumstance where it's either you do it or you don't, and it could be your life or it could be someone else's life that's at stake. All right, so now you're a writer. You're a podcaster. Do you consider yourself a writer who podcasts, a podcaster who writes? Where do you see yourself in this brave new world of media that we're in here?
I consider myself a writer first. I set out thinking I want to do a project in as many different media as possible. I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write a film. I wanted to produce a film. I wanted to do a radio drama. So far, so good. I think that it's a renaissance of audio drama to be able to go to places like Podomatic or Mevio and get your stuff out there and be able to have it judged by your listening audience as opposed to a corporation. But yeah, I consider myself a writer first, and the podcast right now is just the means to the end.
Okay, so it wasn't like you grew up listening to your grandfather's old-timey audio dramas from the 20s
and
30s.
Oh, I did. I don't consider myself an audio drama writer primarily, but I did grow up listening to the AM radio on my dad's Dodge Dart, where he would take me out on his errands in the evening, and our local CBS station would be running reruns of CBS Mystery Theater, and that would just blow me away. I was in a production of Sorry, Wrong Number for radio in drama class one year, and that just fired my enthusiasm for the medium as an economical but also very creative way of telling a story.
We sort of discussed this here and there in the conversation, but the feedback that you've gotten from the listeners of HC World, is it mostly positive, negative, constructive?
Well, if we go strictly by the numbers, there's a lot of silent listeners out there. I think right now we're looking at 900 listeners a day.
Wow.
And downloaders, probably between 150 and 200 downloads per day, which is really surprising and gratifying. But we don't hear a lot from those people. We set up a Facebook page, and we actually have attracted a number of people who've been very supportive and vocal, saying clearly what they don't like about the show and a lot of what they really do like. But the fact that they've joined the Facebook page and the message board and they're free to say what they don't like means that they like the show. So their criticism is constructive.
Mm.
I tend to give more credence to people who temper their enthusiasm for the show with, you know, it could be better if. Because they seem to have a more of an emotional investment in the show than somebody who says, oh, I love the show. It's awesome. You know, give me more now.
It's fanboyism versus, you know, the other extreme, which is just the complete and total hater.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I absolutely love it if somebody's enthusiastic about the show. And I treasure everyone who gives us an hour of their time to listen to an episode. But in the end, it's the listener who's giving us that time. So I want to be able to write the next show to their expectations. And if we're going to increase the bar every episode, then I need more feedback from the people who are going to be listening to us.
Well, that's too bad. I mean, that's, you know, something, again, that you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, where you would hope that people would reply to a request or a question. And, you know, when you go back, you know, there's nothing there. It's like, all right, do they not care? Do they just don't have any feedback to give? I mean, it's always a little odd to not get a response to something sometimes. Yeah.
Especially on the internet. That's kind of concerning.
Yes, exactly. That's what the internet is there. I mean, it's porn and, you know, giving out your opinion, basically, isn't it? I mean, that's what I thought the internet was developed for.
And illegal downloads of movies. Yes, yes.
Exactly. So, yeah, it is a little strange that people wouldn't give their opinion. You know, again, we said that, you know, it's been about a year that HC World has been out and has been strongly growing in fans and downloads. What does your family think? What do your friends think about what you do with HG World? Do they even know? I mean, your friends anyway. I'm sure your family does, but
yeah. Well, my friends and family know that this is kind of a hobby. I don't typically talk about it at work because I'm an HR guy and has nothing to do with that job. And I work in an office where you kind of would get a weird, oh, that's interesting, and then move on to a different topic. But most of my friends are working on the show in some capacity or another. In fact, Mike's one of my best friends. I think I talk to him about as much as I talk to my own wife. And, you know, I've avoided having my kids involved in the show because of the subject matter.
Sure, yeah.
I do have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old who have listened to episodes, and you know, they've gotten some positive feedback from them, and they're very harsh critics. I actually named some characters after old friends I don't see as often anymore. The Happy Valley Militia is actually a group of friends that I used to hang with a long time ago. But they're not based on any individual, but I just drop names in there and references to people and places. And they know about it. They're just like, oh, okay.
It's right. Just JB and J. Okay.
In fact, I killed off most of the Happy Valley Militia by name in the November episode. So the guy looks like Patton Oswalt, Ike or Mike or something like that. Yeah, I just broke his neck. Okay. He kind of went, yeah, thanks.
It could be a little cathartic at times. The junior high bully that tormented you for 4 years, you can write him in and kill him off, right?
Yeah. And I told my friends that it's a sign of affection if I introduce your character and kill him off immediately. And they liked it because, you know, I can't imagine what you would do to me if you had me stick around for more than an episode.
Yeah. I don't know if we've actually said this in the interview, but the happenings on of HG World, for the most part, are taking place in this little valley, the Algonquin Valley here in Pennsylvania. And recently you had posted some pictures on your, speaking of your Facebook fan page, you had posted some pictures of places that inspired some of the locations that you use in HG World. Are any of the locations, are any of them actually real places? Or, again, it's just something inspires you, that would be a great place for X or for Y, you know, that kind of thing.
It's a combination. Wishwell is based loosely on Oil City in northwestern Pennsylvania. And Algonquin County is a combination of the counties up in that area, Tioga and Clarion. But there is no Wishwell, obviously, but there are places that if you travel through central Pennsylvania or western Pennsylvania, you'll see these sharp sloped mountains that are carved out of a river, and you'll see a church on top, and you wonder how the hell people get up there. And I think, and then the syndicate means, well, it would also be a great defensible place for against the zombies. But it's really just a tribute to the rurals of Pennsylvania and how beautiful they are and how remote they are, considering that they're no more than 2 hours from a major city in any direction.
Well, I could be wrong about this, so if I am, please correct me. Did you not post something very recently on Twitter and Facebook that you've written the last episode of HG World?
I wrote the last scene, and I always knew how I wanted it to end, but I had to write it down. Everything goes to that moment, and that's how I wanted to end the show.
Okay, so the show isn't ending per se. It's just you've actually written down how it's going to end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I got a little scared there. I was like, this thing can go on for a little bit longer if you're...
Well, we have 12 episodes in season one. There will be two, maybe three of a special Gugis storyline.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one.
And after that, it really depends on what we want to do. I have another project with 3015 North Studios, which I'm excited about, but it will have to be after HG World wraps up.
How did it feel to write that down?
Strange. It's kind of writing down your own date and time of death and cause, and then putting it off to the side, and you think, you know, inevitably I'm going to have to pick that paper up again. I'm going to have to copy and paste that passage into a script and write the end. But that was the thing. I couldn't bring myself to write the end after that. So, you know, maybe I'll chicken out and
dot, dot, dot.
I don't know. Well, the way I ended, I don't, I won't say anything.
Well, I could just edit that out.
No,
it's because I want to know.
Well,
I'm just kidding. Don't worry about it.
The ending is, I think, very fitting for the way the characters have been going. And I don't want to do a Sopranos ending or a Quantum Leap ending where the viewer is going, what? Wait.
Yeah, actually, I saw that somebody actually, I think, posted that very same thing on the Facebook page where, so wait, you know, please tell me you're not going to, you know, play Journey's, you know, whatever the song was, and Fade to Black not answer any questions at all, right?
No.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit. We're going to get a little geeky here.
Okay.
Just because, well, I'm a geek and that's how it goes. So social media, we've sort of discussed a little bit here and there in the interview that we talk on Twitter and Facebook and whatever. What role do you really see the social media playing in what you do and how you do what you do?
Oh, man, we wouldn't exist without Facebook or Twitter. We would have a website, but no one really, I mean, by numbers, no one goes to our message board or our website compared to the numbers that hit on Facebook. I wouldn't have been introduced to a number of great actors had we not decided to set up a Facebook group that connected to audio or voice actors, audio drama enthusiasts, just fans of zombie horror. I mean, I can make one post and it's seen by fans of George Romero, fans of old time radio drama, and struggling actors in the same window. So that's a great advantage.
It's a very wide net you cast.
Yeah. People would have to Google us to actively find us, whereas Facebook, you know, for good or evil, will suggest things to you that you didn't necessarily know were would be helpful. And it doesn't cost us anything. I mean, the website costs me more to keep up than it obviously takes to maintain the Facebook or the Twitter account.
Sure, yeah.
For a while, having Keith DeCandido as Todd Rage on the Twitter account was pretty cool, and I think that was helpful.
I would love Friday nights because I would wait for HG_world Twitter account, which is the Todd Rage character Twitter account, and he'd send out requests, and I would always send him in requests for zombie songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Zombie Stomp, Zombie by the Cranberries, Zombie Zoo by Tom Petty. It was fun. It was a little goofy. We kind of got a little funny thing going on back and forth for a little while. So yeah, I mean, definitely the presence I think is interesting because I mean I think now the barrier between the fan or the interested party and the creator of content it's drastically reduced to what it used to be. You know, people used to write fan letters to their favorite actor or actress or band member and mail it off. Remember the days when you actually mail things? You know, I mean, now we just, you know, we fire up our browser and we pull up Facebook or Twitter and we say, hey, Jay, this is funny, or this is dumb, or what'd you think about this? Or conversely, you can share what you're seeing or what you're doing or what you're thinking about and reaction from the people that are interested in what you do and what you're doing.
I guess particularly if you're the common definition of a geek and you like genre, science fiction, fantasy, horror, tech, a lot of those people are plugged into those services. I wouldn't be able to talk to a CEO directly, but you know, somebody like Jonathan Mayberry or Max Brooks will likely respond to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a lot of celebrities out there who that's how they pimp their own careers. But also there's a great network of support for a lot of projects that would go nowhere if not for somebody like Keith DeCandido or Dayton Ward saying, hey, check this out. You know, I just got a message from this guy. I think you should check out this podcast or mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. It's really gratifying to log into Facebook and see somebody like Mark Wade accepting your friend's request. Like, oh, wow, Mark Wade.
See, I had that experience with you. I was like, oh, my God, you must be my friend. Oh. I literally ran upstairs into my bedroom and said to my wife was asleep. I said, my God, Jay Smith wants to be my friend on Facebook. She rolled over. She said, that's great, honey. You turn right back.
That's exactly the priority it should be given.
But that's the thing, though, is that for someone like me who I come in as a fan, mm-hmm. you know, I do these interviews with you guys because I like what you do. It's something important to me that I want other people to know about and to experience because I think it's really cool. You and I started to discuss this interview and things on Twitter and on Facebook. I think a lot of relationships are built that way these days. You know, the connections are made and some direct messages here and there, and the next thing you know, it's you're moving somewhere.
Well, it's also something you have to be careful about too, because your politics are out there. Your personal beliefs, and whether they are politics or religion or you know, we were thought about your, if you're a Sox fan or a Yankees fan, that can really play into your professional image. A lot of people have two different Facebook accounts just to separate those lives. I don't. I mean, I don't. Jay Smith on Facebook is me, and the HG World page is the show. I do have fans who have tried who've requested to be friends with me, and I'm very reluctant unless I've talked to somebody to give them access to that, because I've had experiences where, you know, people will put profanity in their status updates, and I'm kind of cool with that, but my kids see it.
Yeah.
But also you people are starting to join groups that are simply pithy taglines. Like, my friend joined a group called Pull Your Damn Pants Up and Be a Man, which I have no idea what that means, but
yeah.
That's a group. You need people to I can bet I can find 1 million people who support people wearing belts. Wait, what?
Yeah, there's some really weird groups out there. I generally don't join them, mm-hmm. more for privacy reasons, because, you know, the first thing that group wants to do or that whatever is it wants to go through your inbox and check out all your friends and, yeah. you know.
And I stopped playing Mafia Wars for that reason.
No, I play. You need to come join my Mafia, man.
That's the thing. I would get so many updates and I'd hide those updates. And,
hey,
right, but yeah, at some point it just becomes, I don't know.
It's overwhelming. It's too much. And I know what you're saying. You know, when you pull up your Facebook account and the entire page is covered with, you know, so-and-so earned this and Farmville and Cherrytown and Mafia Wars, there's no real people updates. You know, I'm doing this. I feel this way. I saw this. You know, yeah, you sort of lose some of that stuff with when there's too much peripheral stuff going on into the feed.
It's also about the mob mentality of the bigger your mafia, the more powerful you are. So people will try to friend other people just to get in their mafia. And there was one day I think I accomplished something in Mafia Wars that in the next hour I had 20 friend requests from people who were friends of friends saying, oh, join my mafia. Let me join your mafia. I don't even know you. I'm not giving you access to my account. Just.
Yeah. I did that for a little while too. And I put them in a special Mafia Wars folder, like a friend folder, and nothing goes out to them.
Mm.
I mean, nothing. The only thing that will, I think, go out is stuff from Mafia Wars. That's it. They don't get my updates. They don't get my pictures. They get access to nothing. And then I said, why even bother to do that? Like, it's not worth my time to have to worry about, did I forget to put somebody in there or whatever? Yeah, no, I agree. It's a bit much. And actually, a buddy of mine just sent out a post a few days ago saying, you know, when I hit level 500, I'm quitting. That's it. It's just getting to be too much. And, you know, I know how I feel. So I'm still addicted. I even play on my iPod and I play online. I play two different places. But yeah, it's getting to the point of where it'll be a little obsessive.
Yeah, I was getting a little crazy there because I finished Moscow and nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And I was so upset that, you know, I didn't get my cookie or I didn't get that congratulations window. Wow, I'm putting way too much importance on this stupid game.
Do you watch South Park?
Yes.
Did you see the episode where the Rockstar Quiero one?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. There's an episode where they're playing Rockstar or Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
And they finally finish the game, and the message that the game plays, I will not say it, but you should go watch it. It's I think it would definitely fit with what you just said 100%.
Okay.
Anyway, back to the actual interview questions here.
Uh-huh.
We're going to try to wrap it up here. So you're a podcaster. Do you listen to other podcasts? And if you do, what do you like to listen to?
I don't have a lot of time to listen, given the show being in production. I have listened to Pendant Audio's dramas. They do some excellent work, some fan-based productions, some original productions. I prefer the original productions over their Superman and Batman simply because I like the originality. I like the creativity that goes into those other shows. I listen to and I contribute to the Chronic Rift podcast, which is pop culture and these days a lot of Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. But I typically there are a couple of shows that I do keep on. I try not to listen to zombie podcasts simply because I don't want to
influence.
Yeah. Or, you know, I tend to start judging, you know, making comparisons. Is this guy's better than us? I gotta kill this character.
Did he steal our stuff? Kind of.
Yeah. That kind of thing. But I do know there are a lot of great zombie casts out there that I really want to listen to. And I think after season one's over, I'll indulge that. But otherwise, you're now in episode, what, six?
This is actually going to be episode 7 when it comes out. But yes, okay. Yeah, be six, the next one that comes out.
I tend to stay away from podcasts that are simply somebody on a soapbox. But I like informative podcasts. I like the interview you did with Ken, and I'm looking forward to listening to his podcast novel. Anything that provides information in an objective and clinical context, but it's also fun, I like to put into my iTunes queue. Mm. So this is one of those shows that goes into the queue.
Oh, cool. Thank
and,
you.
That really don't have a lot of time. I'm trying to catch up on episodes of Lost and Doctor Who.
My problem with Lost is that I didn't watch until this season on TV.
That would be a problem, yes.
I started to watch the first couple episodes. I'm like, okay, Invisible Dinosaur? Yeah, I'm out of here. And I never went back. I didn't get what the thing was all about. I found Netflix was playing, the Watch Instant queue. They had the first four seasons of Lost. I could watch, you know, with my little Roku box. I said, all right, what the hell? So I literally watched seasons 1 through 4 over the course of like a month and a half. Just 2-3 episodes a night just sucked me in. Mm-hmm. And then I watched season 5 on Hulu. And then the problem I discovered was that I was used to just hitting next, 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 and I didn't get that when it's actually being broadcast on TV. Go figure. So what I tend to do is I tend to record like 5 or 6 episodes and then watch a marathon watching. So I think I have 7 episodes on my DVR that have yet to be watched.
I love the mythology. I got caught up in the adventure of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not setting myself up for any big reveal at the end. It's just they captured my attention. I really like the way they're telling this story.
It's fun, yeah.
But I find myself I watched it from the first episode. It captured my attention. I've watched it consistently throughout. But I'm still at the end of this season. I'm thinking, wait a minute, when did that happen? I have to go back and Wikipedia and there's that character knows this character and they're related in somewhere in the space time continuum and that's Universe Q or whatever the hell they're doing now. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's time shift number or whatever.
Yeah, I'm getting old. I can't keep all these facts in my head.
Yeah. All right, so this is the hardest question I'm going to ask you today, Jay. Mac or PC?
The 20-year-old in the back of my head, locked in the basement, screaming Mac. But I own an HP Windows 7.
Oh, very nice.
Only because I couldn't figure out how to get a Macintosh cost-effectively to hook up with my TiVo and our home network so that I could put all of my media together.
Parallels are run the virtual machine on there. So you run the OS 10 on one side, and you run the Windows stuff on the other side, and you run the media stuff through the Windows side. And
yeah, I loved Mac all through college. I swore by it. I bought Macs for our college newspaper and said, this is the wave of the future. And now I'm sitting here staring at a monitor, an HD monitor on an HP, going, I must be old and set in my ways, because
they are insanely expensive too.
Yeah, I remember I used to work for FedEx Kinko's, and back in the day when the G4s came out, and they had, that was the year they introduced the huge 200-pound monitors that looked like the nose cone of a 747 and weighed about as much. It cost more to ship the damn thing than it did to actually buy it. I could have. Let's get off my lawn talk. So,
all right. Next really geeky question: are you running Internet Explorer, Firefox, or Chrome, or some other browser of your choice?
Firefox.
Rock on. Okay. All right. And the last question I asked, this is, I think, going to be my standard final interview question: is what's the one piece of technology you cannot live without, Mr. J. Smith?
Ooh, Audacity.
Really?
Yeah. If I don't have that, I don't have a show.
No, I'm saying really more because I'm surprised that you use Audacity.
Well, I use that for triage. I use a couple of different pieces of software to edit the show. One is Reaper, and Mike will sing the praises of Reaper until he's dead. If I didn't have Audacity and its filtering tools, we would have a much more difficult show to produce.
Wow. I mean, I record my podcast on Audacity, so I just figured it was for us lowly cheapos that, couldn't pony up the money for something real.
Hmm. Oh, well, Reaper is free for valuation, and the valuation is ongoing. It's great to put coin in their pocket because it is a great piece of software, but, if you don't have the means, then Audacity will work.
Interesting. So where can, if people haven't listened to HD World, which they should have, by the way, I've played the promo, people. I'm looking at you. Where can they find HD World?
The best place to start is goodmorningsurvivors.com, which will link the newbies to our message board, to our Wikipedia, give you a background of what you've missed so far, give you a background on all the characters. You can go to the message board and introduce yourself to the cast and crew and other listeners. And it will also take you to our Podomatic site, where all of our episodes have been archived. And it's where we're going to be publishing all of our new episodes beginning May 25th.
So iTunes should not be the way to go?
Well, if you have a podcatcher, you can search for us. Zune or iTunes, just put in HG World or Zombie, and I'm sure we'll pop up. But yeah, if you want to have a long-term relationship with us, and we hope you do, then absolutely. You have a podcatcher, go ahead and look us up on iTunes or Zune or any other fine podcatching system.
All right, well, Jay, thank you for taking the time to talk to me about HD World. Like I said, I sing its praises, anybody who will listen. I hope the people, I hope they heard my enthusiasm for the show and your, obviously, your hard work and your time that you've put into the show. I definitely give it 2 thumbs up.
Oh, thank you.
I would give it more thumbs if I had more thumbs, but I only have 2, so.
No, it's great to have a cast and crew of the quality. If I didn't sell you on the show, I'm definitely not the shill that should be your deciding factor whether or not you listen. Tune in for the cast and Mike's hard work, and I'm sure you'll stick around.
Oh, so 2 last things then before we close this thing out here. One, is it Keith that does the Todd Rage character?
Yes.
Love that man's voice. Holy cow. I don't know whether he drinks a fifth of Jack to get into character or not, but if he does, let me know and I will send him a bottle, because wow, I just the voice, it's so grizzled, and it sounds like he's a nom vet that came back that went through rehab and lost his wife. I mean, he just, the voice is just so great. I definitely love that voice.
Yeah. And Keith turns that stuff around. I will give him lines, and he will turn them around in a couple of hours, depending on what he's working on. And I should point out, Keith DeCandido is one of our best cast members, but he's also an established author. He's going to be penning an upcoming episode about Todd Rage.
Oh, yeah, I saw on the wiki. I forget what it was. Well, they'll find out, unless you know what is on the top of your head.
It's a Long Cold Lonely Winter will be a collection of four short episodes written by partners of the show, friends of the show, but author also people who have more cred in writing publishing industry than I do, like Dayton Ward, who's written some fantastic stuff, and Keith, who's written some Star Trek and is currently writing the Farscape comic series.
Really?
Yeah. Dayton has The Last World War, which is just out. That's on my list of books to read, but he's also written books in the 4400 universe. He's written some Star Trek material as well. He has a military background, so he'll be writing probably something more toward the McGinnis Grant group. And also zombie author Elizabeth Donald will be contributing a segment. And in the future, we'll have other writers like, I'll secure that those those deals before I announce. Terry Osborne is another author, and John Drew will be penning a segment in the future.
You and I were talking, and we were debating whether or not we should have Mike Stokes on the show for the interview, because Mike actually does all of the editing and the sound effects for the show. I would love to have Mike on at a later point in time just to get, you know, I wanted to talk to you about the show and about the creative process, and I was afraid if Mike were on that I would get too off track and not talk to you as much as I wanted to talk to you about the show. You know, if he's available, I would love to talk to Mike at some other point in time and you know, get really geeky with him about what he has to do to get an episode put together and his process and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I talked with Mike about that last night, and he's really enthusiastic about talking about his craft. He's putting together a big thing about, you know, how to get your podcast started, and he is a fountain of wisdom on podcasting and AD.
Well, that's one of the things I greatly benefited from my relationship with Ken Crawford, because, you know, he's an audio engineer essentially, and he happens to write and happens to podcast, and I just lucked out that the man knows how to edit, and he's helped me immensely with my process. Maybe Mike can help me with mine too. I don't know. We'll see.
I'm sure he will. Sure, he will be happy to help.
So I would definitely love to talk to him. All right, well, I mean, again, thank you, Jay, for coming on, and I hope that people really give it a shot, people. It's some good stuff.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mark. It was great talking to you.
I enjoyed it very much. So, all right, so thank you, Jay, and I will talk later. Have a good one, okay?
You too, man.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, folks, that's the Jay Smith interview. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did recording it. If you want to check out HT World, you can head over to their page on Podomatic, which is http://3015north.podomatic.com, and check out episodes there. You can also subscribe to HT World through iTunes or on your podcatcher of choice. The HT World website is www.goodmorningsurvivors.com. Why don't you head over there and say hello and tell them the Dow of Tech sent you. Next week's show, we'll be back on to the tech stuff. I think we're going to be talking about browsers, some apps that I've been playing with, and some other cool tech topics as well. So, folks, the intro music is Schrodinger's Cat Paradox by C-Jax. The outro music is Anhelos, the remastered version. Both tracks are available for download from PodSafe Audio at www.podsafeaudio.com. If you want more of me, please follow me on Twitter. I am twitter.com/markprestash. And as just a reminder, my Twitter stream is a life stream, not just about tech. If you want to email me any questions, comments, corrections, or praise, send them to daospotting@gmail.com. That is taospotting@gmail.com. Now, please stay tuned after the closing music and listen to the awesome promo for Paul E. Cooley's novel Tattoo. Thanks for listening, guys, and I will talk to you all next week. Bye now.
Stars. They remind us who we are, what we are, and where we have been. But when a scar takes away your identity, what would you do to get it back? Tattoo. The Parsec Award nominated horror novella from Paul Eller Cooley's Themes Collection, now available as an ebook from Smashwords.com and Amazon.com for 99 cents. For more information, visit ShadowPublications.com. We don't believe in happy endings.